Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Earthquakes are the talk of the town lately. Haiti with a magnitude 7, Chile with a magnitude 8.8, and on Monday a magnitude 6 in Turkey, small one in Ohio in late February as well. Are they connected? Should we be worried? What has been done to prepare us for that? No matter how many disaster movies I see, well, except for the day after tomorrow in 2012, of course, Ohio always feels safe. But are we? We invited our three guests today to talk about those topics. Max Swinford is the Assistant Chief of the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, Division of Geological Survey. Welcome to the show, Mac.
Good morning.
And also from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, Mike Hansen. He's the Coordinator for the Ohio Seismic Network, which is in the Division of the Geological Survey. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And joining us later in the show, Steve Rigoli, a senior staff with the Ohio Board of Building Standards, where, among other things, he develops Ohio's construction codes. We'll be talking to you in a little while. Steve, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
I guess after the quake in Chile and then the small one in Ohio a few weeks ago, and then the magnitude 6.0 that hit a remote part of Turkey on Monday, there were a few questions about 2012 out there in the internet ether. It seems like a lot of people get more concerned when there is a big quake somewhere in the world, even though it may have nothing to do with Ohio. Is that the case, Mike?
Oh, yes, definitely. So people see this tremendous damage and so on television and hear it on the radio as well. And that piques their interest in earthquakes. And, of course, they wonder, could it happen here in Ohio?
What about you, Matt? Same thing?
Yeah, the interest is peaked because I think maybe the proximity of Haiti.
It feels closer.
It feels closer, mm-hmm. And maybe some Ohioans have actually been there. And this isn't on the other side of the planet like the 2004 Sumatran earthquake with the tsunami that, of course, riveted everybody's attention for a number of weeks. So all of this just heightens earthquake awareness, which is a good thing.
Particularly in a state like Ohio that could eventually suffer some major damages if there's a big one that blows out there, but that we're not usually people don't think about them very often because they're usually, at least where we feel in central Ohio, quite mild. First, what causes an earthquake?
Well, earthquakes are results of movement along faults, which are cracks in the Earth's crust. Mm-hmm. And those faults are everywhere in the Earth's crust, and we have a number of them here in Ohio. But what causes that fault to fail is when there is stress that builds up in the crust. For example, North America is slowly moving westward as the Atlantic Ocean becomes wider, and those stresses are accumulated in the crust, and we have ancient zones of weakness going well back into geologic time, and those are weak points. And when the stress builds up, we have a small earthquake.
Mac, why can't we predict them? You always hear that you can't predict an earthquake. Why is that?
That science is, of course, ongoing is the big seismological question of trying to predict earthquakes. But it is still something that's largely unpredictable. We can find ways to examine the strain by using lasers as a new technology, but we can analyze the amount of strain that's building up across the fault. For instance, the San Andreas fault, which is the most studied fault probably in the world, but when that energy will be let loose in terms of an earthquake is something that is pretty much not predictable at this point, perhaps someday.
How do lasers measure the strain?
You set up a laser going across the fault, which is a known surface of movement. For instance, the San Andreas fault is actually a transform fault. It doesn't move up and down. It moves sideways. And so they can measure using a laser the amount of movement to millimeters or less across by having a laser on one side being picked up by a monitoring station on the other side.
And so, it can show that it's changing.
Yes.
And building up.
And building up, yeah.
Okay. Why don't we use the Richter scale anymore? I always liked how 7.5 on the Richter scale sounded.
Well, the Richter scale is kind of a thing that's changed a lot. It was originally developed by Charles Richter, who was a Cincinnati native, by the way, in California for California earthquakes. So it uses a mathematical formula or equation to determine the magnitude. However, that doesn't apply very well outside of California in many areas. So we use a slightly different algorithm here in Ohio for our Midwest-type earthquakes. So we just refer to it as the magnitude scale rather than specifically Richter.
So you measure it differently?
Slightly differently, yes. For the average person, it's probably not relevant, but when we calculate these things, we try to do this very accurately.
There's that scientific way of looking at it and measuring it, and then there's also other measurements about what the what it feels like and what it felt like, what it's going to feel like, what a 7.7 might feel like.
Right, and that's called intensity, and that has another Mercalli scale, which is Roman numerals 1 through 11 or
12.
12? Yeah, it's 12. With 12 being total destruction and 1 being barely felt, and so typically in Ohio, we would get 3s and 4s and 5s on the intensity scale here, and it's all based on things that people feel, rattling dishes versus the dishes falling on the kitchen floor and breaking, and those are things that. With that information, we can travel around and get intensity readings because of the damage and then do what we call isoseismal maps where we can show the damage outwardly in a radial fashion from the epicenter.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about earthquakes, if you haven't figured that one out yet. And my guests are Mike Hansen, coordinator of the Seismic Network, in the Ohio Department of Natural Resources Division of the Geological Survey, and also Max Swinford. He is Assistant Chief of the Ohio Department of Natural Resources Division of Geological Survey. How do we know where an epicenter is? In fact, when I look back at the record of earthquakes in Ohio that go back to 1776, I think, at least as far as the known ones, they actually talk about a probable epicenter. And I think, how many people were even here then? How do you know that? How do you even imagine that?
Well, when we go back before we had seismographs around, that was just based upon the felt reports, that is scouring old newspaper files and so on, where people felt it and where they felt it the strongest is where we place the epicenter. Certainly those, what we call pre-instrumental epicenters, are not very accurate. However, today we use our seismographs, of which we have 25 operating in the state of Ohio as part of our network, and we record these earthquakes in the state on those instruments. We determine when the earthquake waves arrive at each station, and then we put that through a software program that basically does a triangulation. We have to use three or more stations on that. And typically, we locate most of these small earthquakes in Ohio with an accuracy of less than a kilometer, often about a half a kilometer. So we have a very precise location, and that helps us identify where the faults may be in the state as well.
How do you decide where to put those 25 seismographs? Who gets them?
Yeah, who gets them? That's a good question. Well, many of them are based in institutions of higher learning, universities. Ohio University, OSU has one. Kent State.
So it's Bowling near Green. The researchers then.
And but they're in some high schools also. If we can find an enthusiastic high school teacher who is interested in earthquakes, they can. And gather the small amount of funds it takes to set up a seismograph in their some quiet part of the building, and the seismograph is hooked up to a computer, which collects the signals, and then it's actually on the internet. So Mike can be here in Columbus and downloading seismograms from all 25 stations to triangulate the epicenter of an earthquake.
Is there public access to those?
Yes, if you have the right software, and indeed we're going to have a link to some software people can use to actually look at these seismograms. But yes, that's publicly available from our website.
Okay. Well, we'll put that link on our website. If you want to go to our website, wosu.org/allsides, I'll have that link for you later. The threat from – well, first, the 25 seismographs. I want to go back to that. So somebody could call you up and say, we want to put a seismograph in our school, or are you limited to 25?
No,
there's no limit.
There's no limit to this. All of our stations are run by volunteers. They don't receive any compensation for this. And we initially bought 15 seismograph stations, equipment for them, and placed them at these various institutions, primarily based on two things. One, location near active areas of earthquake activity in Ohio, and secondly, and obviously very important, somebody that's interested in taking care of the station. And since that time, we have had a number of stations where they have bought their own equipment and set up their own seismograph station to be part of our network. So that's been very helpful to us.
Does it matter where – you said you got them in institutions. I imagine you spread them out among institutions that could be – to reveal as much information as possible.
Correct, yes.
So, but otherwise, whoever wants one can get one. But there are hot spots in Ohio.
Yes, we wouldn't turn down anybody that wanted to put in their own station. But in our selecting locations, we've tried to put them in our active areas of northeastern Ohio and western Ohio.
From reading or from listening to all the news reports and everything and reading about them, about the very large earthquakes in Haiti and also in Chile, I heard this and I was reminded of it last night when I was working on my research that the threat from very large earthquakes is the duration of the quake, not necessarily the strength of the shaking. And I wondered why that is the case and why some last longer than others.
Well, if a strong earthquake had a duration of 1 or 2 seconds, perhaps a building could withstand the shaking. But when it goes on for a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, the structure just cannot withstand, even if it's steel reinforced.
So it could be a lesser earthquake too, but if it went on for a long time, that is where –
Yes, that's true. And I was kind of making a point to get back to the network. We have a seismograph here in Columbus on Morse Road at our headquarters, and I saw the 8.8 magnitude earthquake come in from Chile, and our seismograph was off scale for about an hour here in Columbus.
Wow.
Yes.
So the seismograph is much more sensitive than we are, obviously.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And we didn't feel it, but the seismograph was off scale.
Was it the Chile one? I think the one where they say that the Earth actually lost time or it changed the tilt of the Earth.
That was a calculation done by NASA on that, but work by Mike Beavis in our geology department here at Ohio State. Using GPS measurements in Chile, indicated that the crust moved westward about 10 feet in Chile. And the calculation is that shifted the mass of the Earth by a small amount. Therefore, that changed the axis, what's called the mass or figure axis, and that slowed down the Earth by milliseconds.
Weird. We have to take a break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
As bombs fell on Baghdad in the first Gulf War, poet Sinan Antoun focused on his writing.
When I was torn by war, I took a brush, immersed in death, and drew a window on war's wall.
I'm Neil Conan, Poets on the Power of Poetry. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation begins this afternoon at 2 o'clock. It's here from 2 until 4. Also on Talk of the Nation today, it's Wednesday, so the political junkie is stopping by to discuss all things politics. And good morning from WOSU 820 NPR News. 50 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20. Cloudy skies today, a chance of some morning rain and a high of 62.
Support for WOSU comes from The Other Paper, Columbus's news and entertainment weekly, on newsstands every Thursday and online at theotherpaper.com.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining me today to talk about earthquakes is Mike Hansen. He is coordinator of the Seismic Network and the Ohio Department of Natural Resources Division of the Geological Survey, and also Max Winford, the Assistant Chief of the Ohio Department of Natural Resources Division of the Geological Survey. Is it the Geological Survey or just Geological Survey?
You know, we've talked about that for years. You know, we've had debates whether the belongs there or not.
Okay. It's not just me then. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And if you were listening earlier, Mike mentioned a website you can go to for more information about the Ohio Seismic Network. Go to ohiodnr.com/ohioseis, and we will also post that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Also joining us is Steve Rigoli. He is many things, but senior staff with the Ohio Board of Building Standards, where, among many things, he develops Ohio's construction codes. And we're going to kind of morph the conversation into, are we prepared, you know, eventually? So, Steve, just jump right in whenever it seems appropriate. We do have a couple phone calls right now, and what the heck? Let's take them. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm interested in geology. I also happen to own a brick house that's over 120 years old.
Ooh.
So I think about earthquakes. And as a matter of fact, I do have earthquake insurance. My agent thought I was nuts when I got it. In Ohio, in this part of Ohio at least, what are the probabilities for different earthquakes? I don't know what scale, but like, for example, could we say, well, every 100 years we can expect to have a 4.0, every 1,000 years a 5.0, every 10,000 years a 6.0, et cetera? Any rough estimates on those? And is there any place online or someplace where I can get those kind of charts or graphs or whatever would explain that?
Well, that's a very good question. The probability is very low, of course, in Ohio that we're going to have a major, huge, damaging earthquake. In central Ohio, that's relatively low. Earthquakes are not generally centered here in central Ohio, but in our western part of the state or northeastern Ohio, we have had damaging earthquakes. Indeed, we've had 15 damaging earthquakes in the state of Ohio since records have been kept, including in 1937 in Shelby County, an earthquake that was about a 5.4 magnitude that knocked down or damaged every chimney in the town of Anna, and including damaging the school so badly it had to be torn down. One of the problems we have here in the eastern United States is the long recurrence interval of large earthquakes. These large earthquakes may occur every few hundred years or perhaps even a few thousand years. However, our record historically is only about 200 years long, so we don't really know how often a big earthquake like this can hit.
How can you make suppositions then about them? Because I know, was it with the San Andreas, another big one in about 500 years since the last one, which put us about 300 years away from that. How do you determine possibly when it might come?
Well, that's, a very difficult thing to do. Partly that's done through, of course, historic records, but also we can look at ancient earthquakes through what we call paleoseismology. And this consists of basically looking at evidence along exposures of sediments where we see disturbed sediments in there. Those can be radiocarbon dated. These disturbed sediments, of course, have been caused by large earthquakes. And this has been done particularly in the New Madrid, Missouri area, which is the greatest threat probably in the Midwest, where we had three and possibly four earthquakes in the 8 magnitude range in 1811 and 1812. By looking at the paleo evidence, that is ancient evidence in the New Madrid area, they've come up with the figure of about every 500 years one of these very large earthquakes hits that particular area. Unfortunately, we don't have such evidence in Ohio as yet.
And I mispronounced New Madrid, the common pronunciation. Mike, did that help?
Yeah, it did. Any places online where I can find out more about this stuff?
Yeah, we have a link. Go to WOSU.org/allsides, and that link to the Ohio Seismic Network is up now.
Great. Thank you very much.
You bet. I would repeat that link, except it's more complicated and harder for me to remember. So I'm like a trained monkey. I can do our own very easily. Going back to the New Madrid, it's at the junction of Tennessee, Arkansas, and Missouri, and it is a whopper, and that we would feel it when it blows here. I read that the largest earthquakes to hit the continental United States were from that fault.
That's
the largest. Yeah. I mean, we think about those earthquakes out in California, and it doesn't seem possible that it would rival those.
Yes, that I think is surprising to almost everyone. Of course, Ohio was sparsely populated in 1811, mm-hmm. 1812. Our largest city was Cincinnati with 2,500 people. But those earthquakes were large enough that they knocked down chimneys and did damage in Cincinnati. And, of course, today with a much greater population density, much more detailed infrastructure and such, we could have some very significant damage even as far away as Ohio from those earthquake epicenters.
Yeah, they say that Memphis could be destroyed.
Absolutely.
If it comes to that. Give us a yeah, –
well, I was going to say, and the geology of the Midwest allows for this energy to transfer great distances, much more than it is in California. And so I believe those 1811 earthquakes rang bells in Philadelphia.
In Boston, yes.
In Boston.
They heard them on the bell towers. Yeah, I read about that.
So that's
they
just,
felt them.
It's a good picture of how this energy travels in the Midwest.
Why does it travel so far versus in California? It's pretty a narrow –
In a nutshell, California has a lot of geology that is broken and busted, and so the energy is attenuated, is reduced as it's trying to get across this broken rock. In Ohio and in the Midwest, the geology is rather continuous, and there are breaks, but it's a kind of a solid mass where if you ring the bell on one side, the energy travels very efficiently through that and can ring the bell on the other.
Yeah, the felt area and damage area from the Midwest compared to California is about 10 times greater in the Midwest than it would be California from the same size earthquake.
Okay, 614-292-8513, if you want to join us. Mark, you're on the air. You want to talk about cracking shale?
Yeah. Yeah, if I could, Ann. I've got a question for your guest, and if they had time, maybe a few more specific concerns. There's been a lot of talk. I've been raising this issue for a few years on the Marcellus Shale in the Appalachian Plateau, where they're injecting water and chemicals at very high pressures underground to fracture rock layers. And there's also a process that even OSU and Battelle have worked a little bit on, carbon sequestration technologies, where the plan is basically to turn the smokestacks upside down on power plants and inject the CO2 and gases at extremely high pressures in underground layers of rock or salt domes. And I'm wondering if you see any potential to increase either the possibility or the severity of earthquakes due to those, we'll say, terraforming activities that we're engaged in.
I think one of those disaster movies out there was based on that. Mac, what do you think?
First of all, the Marcellus Shale, it's a huge new gas play or field over in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and not quite in Ohio yet, but there's a really high carbon shale layer thousands of feet down. They're injecting water into this at high pressures to fracture the shale in order to release the gas. There has been no, to my knowledge, no documented earthquake activity directly connected with this fracking activity. And the other question was the carbon sequestration, where we would take the carbon dioxide and turn it into a liquid state and to reduce the volume and pump it underground. And this is a common practice in Texas, and it actually revitalizes old oil and gas fields. and is being looked at here in Ohio, and there has been no documented earthquake activity directly connected with carbon sequestration to date.
In the first type of, you said fracking, could it cause a problem? I mean, has anyone looked and speculated about it? Obviously, someone speculated, Mark wouldn't be calling, but where does that speculation stem from?
Well, I think there's always that kind of fear of something that gets a lot of publicity. But hydrofracking, as it's called, has been used in the oil and gas industry for decades, and with hundreds and actually thousands and thousands of wells drilled, and there's essentially no earthquakes being induced from that particular activity.
Mark, did that answer your questions?
A little bit. One of my books I've got at home, I'm at work, it's called Texas Earthquakes, and it actually raises the issue of where you're either injecting or withdrawing water or gases at great pressure differentials underground. It actually can increase the risk of earthquakes. But earlier your guests were talking about the coastal range in California where it's very fractured, mm-hmm. and that's one of the main, with earthquakes, landslides, reservoirs filling up, one of the reasons the coastal range in California is so unstable is because it's so fractured, and that's one of the concerns with, if you're making fractured mountain or plateaus, you could increase that kind of activity here as a potential, and
you're thinking maybe like the fracture that broke the camel's back kind of a thing.
Yeah, and this is deep under the Appalachian. Somewhat would be below sea level, and some might be right about sea level. And there's also the mountaintop mining, where they're basically cutting off the tops of the mountains and filling in the valleys with loose, unconsolidated mm-hmm. materials, which, like, there's a city in Japan that was built on unconsolidated materials on the coast. And when they had an earthquake, it gelled, and it was almost like a pyroclastic flow. And just you could possibly, if you ever did have an earthquake, those mountaintop removal valley fills could just flow out of the mountains.
Thanks, Mark, for your call. You know, that does bring up an issue I was going to talk about, is the makeup of the earth in the Midwest is different. It's looser. It moves more. Is that part of why things travel so far?
Well, no. The bedrock geology is fairly well connected, and it's not broken a great deal. And so the energy travels efficiently over it. However, in Ohio, two-thirds of Ohio is covered by glacial deposits, which is unconsolidated materials, which if your house is foundation is on bedrock, you might not feel the shaking of an earthquake. But your neighbor a mile away, whose house is or foundation is on glacial till, actually would feel it quite soundly, because the clays of the glacial till actually amplify the energy before it reaches the surface. So it has to do with construction of houses and what they're constructed on, and then also, of course, the construction of the house itself.
Which was brought up earlier. Brick is doesn't hold well, and I can't remember his name now, but he's wise to have earthquake insurance if you have a brick, particularly an older brick house. Cincinnati is particularly vulnerable because of its topography. Not only is it closer, but it also, because of all the hills and the mudslides it already has, is that the case?
Well, yes, we do have landslides in Cincinnati. In fact, that's a big problem in Cincinnati. If we got a very large earthquake, say in New Madrid, there's always that potential that it could trigger some landslides in the Cincinnati area. I wouldn't say, though, in general, that the topography makes it more earthquake prone.
Okay. But more vulnerable to earthquakes. I mean, to damage from earthquakes.
And it gets back to what I was talking about earlier, is it depends on what the city is built on. And mm-hmm. the city of downtown Cincinnati is built on hundreds of feet of lake clay, which is susceptible to liquefaction in a large shaking episode, such as the New Madrid earthquake, a large one traveling up into Ohio. That's where we're concerned about Cincinnati and the bridges, the approach ramps to the bridges specifically.
Steve Rigoli from the Board of Building Standards, let's talk about, are there codes related to what a house or a structure might be built on that relate to the earthquake?
Yeah, and I think your listeners will be comforted to know that the building code system we have in place today and probably for the last 50 years has always maintained some provisions for earthquake consideration in the design of buildings. Now, even today, our residential codes have section that deals with seismicity and considerations. But fortunately, as the code, as the buildings have grown, so has the sophistication of our codes, so that the codes that we have in place today, I would say, in comparison to, say, the Chile quake, their standard that they developed was based on some of the same technical data that our codes have used in Ohio and nationally for since 2007. We update those codes roughly every 3 years. Their system is not quite like that, and they're based on – they look to North America for how we do things and how we've done things. So some of the same technical standards that we use are the basis of their seismic codes requirements. Because we're mid-plate, we're not at one of the plate edges where you do have much, much more breaking – movement. Seismically, we're just a different condition. I think of the 200-plus earthquakes we've had since the 1700s above 2, which is magnitude 2, which you can actually start to feel. We've only had about 15 or so that we would say move into some other magnitude ranges. So I think all buildings are built with those calculations being done. We actually take a snapshot of the earth itself, the top 100 feet. We have to classify sites based on the type of stuff it's built on. Then we classify the building on what it's made of. And one of the listeners, if he can go on to the Google, point his browser to Ohio Board of Building Standards, and you'll find a link to Ohio E-Codes. You can actually go to Chapter 16 of the Building Code and look at the maps. And we have maps that have been developed by a consortium of people. The FEMA, obviously, is involved, the National Institute of Science, and and also NIST, National Institute of Science and Technology. And we've developed maps based on historical information, but they're probability maps. What is the chance of an earthquake at this place exceeding this value within 50 years? So those contours on the map help us then select values of shear that we need to design our buildings to resist. So again, geographically, geologically, as you move around the state, you have to consider the site and its geologic factors. You look at the building and how it moves in response to the earthquake that might be there. And what we found over the years is that even though engineers do those calculations for commercial buildings that get built, we're more susceptible to wind, water and flooding, snow. Those are the factors that ultimately prevail as bigger loads imposed on structures. So I think our listeners can be pretty comfortable that the buildings they're in, live, work in, are safe. And it doesn't mean there may not be some damage, but they won't have a situation similar to Haiti where you have brittle structures, unreinforced, a system of basically no system of codes or inspections. And people were lost because buildings collapsed. There was progressive failure, and they pancaked, basically. So we lost 250,000 people there as opposed to Chile where they lost 700. Mm-hmm. And the magnitude of the
earthquake – in a much more populous area.
And the earthquake in Chile was about had about 500 times the energy released. Yeah. So mm-hmm. You can see that there's some real benefit. And we're, as I said, kind of ahead of the – curve as far as the standards we use to develop our codes on.
We have to take another short break. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is Capital City Radio. Welcome to Sound Opinions from Chicago Public Radio and American Public Media. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Cobb. This week, Jim.
And this is Capital City Radio.
I would rather go blind, boy.
Capital City Radio is the center of music and news. The new service from WOSU. Online at capitalcityradio.org. And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, hour two of All Sides will be here. A recent report of rape at Ohio State University highlights crime alert policies at OSU and at colleges around the country. We'll hear about the frequency of sexual assaults on campuses and programs and resources for prevention and treatment of sexual violence. That discussion is at 11 o'clock on All Sides, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Cloudy skies today, a chance of rain, a high of 62 degrees. Clouds tonight, a low of 45. And a good chance of rain on Thursday, maybe a thunderstorm in the afternoon, a high of 62 tomorrow. Currently 50 degrees in downtown Columbus.
Support for WOSU comes from Ohio Wesleyan University, congratulating its students on receiving the Presidential Award for Higher Education Community Service. Last year, nearly 1,800 Ohio Wesleyan students gave their time and talent to help others. OWU.edu.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about earthquakes in Ohio, the incidence of them. What does it mean? Do we have anything to worry about if you want to be comforted? Go to the Ohio Board of Building Standards, Chapter 16 of the E-Code. Apparently, that will comfort you. So do that. Go to the Ohio Board of Building Standards. We'll get a link up on our website at wosu.org/allsides as soon as we can. 614-292-8513 if you have a question or comment. And Jonathan, you're on the air. You want to talk about the predictability of earthquakes. Now, I already asked him about that. Is this something different?
Well, actually, I guess I missed the first 10 minutes. But I do, but my question is probably different anyway.
Okay.
And actually, I have two questions, and I'll take the response off the air.
Okay.
First, I'm wondering how the technology of science of the last 50 years has increased or improved the probability of predicting earthquakes and perhaps extending the early warning system. And the other question, which may or may not be related, is I'm wondering whether extraterrestrial effects, meaning the movement of other planets, have anything to do with seismic activity on our planet.
Okay.
And that'll do it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jonathan, for waiting. Okay.
Interesting questions there. Predictability of earthquakes is very difficult. The problem we always face is that no two earthquakes are exactly the same. The rocks are different. The stresses are different. Different parts of the world, of course, different depths and so on. So there's just not a factor you can use in there that say this is the magic key to predicting earthquakes. There's a little bit of stress, of course, put onto the planet by the moon and its different phases and so on as it moves around and planets lining up and so on. But those forces are so small compared to the tectonic forces of the plates moving that they have little effect on earthquake activity. That is a subject that has been studied for many years in great detail, and there's never a strong correlation between planetary alignments and so on and earthquakes.
Ohio, let's go back to the shallow versus deep and the distinction between those kinds of earthquakes. Mac?
Well, if you go on the NEIC, National Earthquake Information Center website, it's another good place to Google to find out with a listing of the latest earthquakes in going on around the world. One on the list, you'll see kilometers depth of the focus, which is the actual place deep in the earth where the break in the rock occurred. And you'll see places in Indonesia where it's actually hundreds of miles deep. And these earthquakes are quite large, 6 and 7 on a modified magnitude. But the fact that they're so deep that the energy dissipates before it gets to the surface. Here in Ohio, we typically look at earthquakes and give them a 5 kilometer focus when we do our calculations. And those are quite shallow, so the energy travels to the surface quite quickly and doesn't have time to dissipate.
And in Haiti and Chile?
What we were talking, Steve, you had
I think
those
numbers. I read that the Chile earthquake was 20 miles deep, and the Haiti earthquake was something like 8 miles deep.
And that's shallow compared to, say, like, as you said earlier.
Yes.
Ohio geologically contains both fault and rift zones. And I was wondering if you could explain what the difference is between a rift.
Rift is is extensional in nature. If you had three books held together and you pulled them apart, the middle book would fall down, would go down between the other two. And that's actually something called a graben. And that's that would be what a rift would look like. And in western Ohio, we have such rifts, which are about a billion years old, and they're filled in with thousands of feet of sediment. And in fact, we didn't know this rift even existed at the Geological Survey until the late 1980s when we bumped into it with a drill hole that we drilled. And we it was a core, actual continuous cylinder of rock. And we kept drilling and drilling, and we drilled about another 1,000 or 1,100 feet of this unknown sedimentary rock, and we finally had to stop, which was good because we had another 5,000 feet to go before we would have hit the bottom. There's no way we were going to get there. So
This was the middle section, the book that fell.
The book that fell. And so the plane between the two outer books would be faults, and those are points of weakness. And those in Ohio are you know, a billion years old, but they're still being reactivated because of pressure, extensional or compressional, that's built up over time. And again, it gets back to this time that it takes a long period of time for this pressure strain to build up in Ohio. That's very, very quick in California, but it's slow here in Ohio. So thus the frequency of earthquakes is over a much longer time.
And our western Ohio earthquakes are all concentrated along that rift zone.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, Shelby County, out that way.
Yes.
614-292-8513, if you would like to join the conversation. Arthur, you're on the air.
Yes, ma'am. Two questions, and then I'll ring off.
Okay.
I understand that historically there was a really major earthquake in Charleston, South Carolina in 1880-something. Which devastated the city and may have even killed more people than the San Francisco earthquake did. And secondly, I read someplace that the Hudson River Valley is essentially a gigantic fault line. And as far as I know, New York City is not prepared at all to deal with an earthquake. I'll turn on my radio to hear your comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Arthur.
The Charleston, South Carolina earthquake was in August 31st, 1886, actually. And we actually had an earthquake in Ohio that same day, very small one. But that was an area people wouldn't even expect an earthquake. But we actually have a rift zone in the Charleston area, similar to our western Ohio one. And Charleston does not get a lot of small earthquakes on a daily basis, like we see in California or even in New Madrid. But the one in 1886 killed about 60-some people and did a tremendous amount of damage in the city of Charleston.
Steve, you were talking about the building codes earlier. Are commercial building codes different than residential?
Yes and no. That's the commercial codes obviously have to deal with a lot more complex considerations, because most of the light frame construction we use in residential construction, even multifamily, is flexible. It's light frame and not masonry or concrete as most of the rest of the world uses. And because of that, even if there are any kind of movements, whether it's even wind, snow, they're more able to deal with that. The new codes in residential have added a lot more factors that tie the pieces of the building together, clips and anchorages. But the science, having to convert all this information you heard Mike and Mac talk about, have to converting that to usable data, that basic information applies to both residential and commercial. Now, I think it's much more farly advanced in design because the complexity of design in commercial buildings is a lot different. But the underlying science, the maps, the probabilities are all considered for both residential and construction, commercial construction.
614-292-8513. Give us a call if you want to join. Sven, you're on the air.
Hi. Hey, I was wondering if earthquakes cause sonic booms or if sonic booms can cause earthquakes.
We were talking about that earlier. Mac,
I didn't hear that.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we were on the air. Sorry.
Almost always when there's an earthquake in Ohio, people report hearing a booming sound followed by a brief episode of shaking. This booming sound they hear is when the fastest moving earthquake waves, which we call P or primary waves, exit the ground. They go into audible frequencies. So when those earthquake waves arrive at wherever you are, if you're close to the epicenter, you'll hear that booming sound. Now, we do get sonic booms occasionally, even though aircraft are not supposed to exceed the sound barrier across Ohio. We have periodically we can document these things. They don't cause very much ground motion. Sometimes we can see a little bit of ground motion on our instruments, but it's not the same as an earthquake. Many people hear the sonic boom and think it's an earthquake, and conversely, they experience the earthquake and think the booming sound is a sonic boom. So we can sort that out by looking at our records.
Yeah, I live in the Chillicothe area, and about a week and a half ago, we had a small earthquake, and we had a sonic boom from it. And I heard about that afterwards, and I've never heard that before.
Well, we got lots of reports from the Chillicothe, Waverly area of people feeling or hearing this booming sound. And that was in the evening.
Yeah, I felt the shake, too.
Well, I looked at that, of course, on our seismographs, and we saw no evidence of an earthquake in the Chillicothe area. We had the earthquake, of course, in Fostoria in northwestern Ohio. Very small 2.4 earthquake felt in Fostoria and just a few miles outside of Fostoria, but it has no connection to the Chillicothe thing. We've not been able to determine exactly what the boom was in the Chillicothe area, but I suspect it was a sonic boom from an aircraft or possibly even from a meteoroid entering the atmosphere, which will also cause sonic booms.
Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. How do I know it's an earthquake and not a train going by? I'm trying to get my – I don't know if I've ever felt an earthquake before.
Well, I get probably at least one or two reports via email or phone call every day of people somewhere in the state that think they felt an earthquake. And almost always it's not an earthquake. Usually when there is an earthquake, we start getting dozens, if not hundreds, okay, of calls and emails coming in because it's felt so widely. Many times atmospheric and cultural things can cause a shaking. When all the snow was on the roofs of the houses across the state, and I had this happen at my house, a big chunk of snow slides off and the whole house shakes. And we were starting to get lots of reports of people thinking they were feeling earthquakes, and it was probably snow sliding off the roof.
That happened at the hockey rink in Worthington. It really it was a weird feeling.
I believe Mike receives a lot of these phone calls, and I think – I don't know whether it's apocryphal story, but I think Mike's phone starts ringing before the P wave actually reaches Mike at all times of the day. But he gets – his phone starts ringing and does not stop.
Yeah, you know, as far as planning for it, I know that we're not, you know, there aren't FEMA people in here, but an earthquake that is a low probability, high consequence event means that it's harder to get people prepared for it if it does hit.
Yes, I don't. People don't perceive a danger if something they have not experienced themselves or in their lifetime or even their immediate family's lifetime. So things that happened 100 years ago, 50 years ago, people don't perceive that as a danger. And indeed, people shouldn't be worrying about this all the time. But we do, of course, have a danger of a damaging earthquake in the state of Ohio. Probably not a major devastating one like we're seeing on the news every day here recently, but certainly not is not a probability that's zero. For us.
And it could shut down power, it could shut down transportation and that sort of thing. It may not knock your house down, but
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to add too that one of the advantages we have, because I've been involved with some of the, as these guys have too, EMA's work. They do training on some of the seismic issues as far as assessment of existing buildings and things. But we can be confident that any of these high impact disasters, whether it's snow, wind, mm-hmm. rain, flooding, we've seen, especially on tornadoes, which is probably the biggest life-threatening condition we have in Ohio, how quickly county EMAs and the surrounding EMAs do respond, because there you do have damage to structures, infrastructure damage, potable water, electricity, telephone. So I would think that in these earthquakes, even if they were to be higher than some of the felt earthquakes and did cause damage, that were that same infrastructure would kick in, and I think we'd be pretty well served by it.
Yes, I think they're well prepared, and I would add that the Ohio Emergency Management Agency has been a loyal supporter of our earthquake monitoring activities in the state.
We just have a little bit of time left. I can only have time for one more call. And Gary, you're on the air. Can you make it quick?
Yep. Okay. I just wonder if some of the underground nuclear tests that have been run over the years didn't have some effect on the tectonic plates and their movements.
Okay. Thank you. Who wants to grab that one? Mike?
I'll give it a try here.
You only have 30 seconds or so.
I'm not aware of any evidence. Of course, these nuclear tests can be picked up on seismographs around the world, and indeed there are ones dedicated to that. But as far as moving on the tectonic plates, those are comparatively small compared to the amount of pressure that is involved with moving tectonic plates.
Okay, we're just about out of time. Hopefully you can go to WOSU.org/allsides and get those links that we talked about earlier to learn more about, let's see, what do we call it, the Division of the Geological Survey in the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, and also go to the Ohio Board of Building Standards to learn more about how Ohio's codes reflect the research on earthquakes in the area. We are out of time now. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I want to thank my guests for joining me today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.